Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. Today, we're talking to Composer, a company bringing hedge fund grade algorithmic trading to consumers. They just raised $6.7 million from First Round and have gone absolutely viral on Reddit, which is sort of where the company was born. We dive into how to build products that are both flexible and powerful, creating social viral products, and where fintech is going. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Composer co-founders Ben Roller and Ananda Ayasola. And check out the newsletter. I break down the news and have started writing essays taken from what I learn on this podcast. Things like vertical farming and crypto economy games. So check it out. You can find it at workweek.com. I'm a big fan of Marketer Hire, the wonderful sponsors of this show. They're matching elite marketing professionals with ambitious startup founders. Using advanced AI and a thorough vetting process, Marketer Hire will match your business with a top-tier marketer, and they'll do it quickly. Get signed up today and find your marketing professional at marketerhire.com. Ben and Ananda, it is great to have you both on the show. I am really looking forward to diving into Composer. So to start us off, what exactly are you building at Composer for investors?
Composer is an automated trading platform that allows retail investors to easily build a portfolio of systematic trading strategies. So instead of struggling to implement strategies themselves with endless lines of code or cobbling together spreadsheets, Composer breaks the strategy creation process into these building blocks that can be infinitely combined using a no-code visual editor. And once you create a strategy that you like, Composer makes it easy to automatically execute trades based on that strategy's logic. And then if you're not ready to build a strategy from scratch, we have this really nice library, sort of like the Spotify of strategies, that allows you to discover pre-existing templates. And if you like one of those, you can invest in one of those. So in the end of the day, Composer makes these kinds of strategies that top hedge funds use as easy to access as individual stocks or ETFs.
So let's say I started on Robinhood. My investing is starting to get more sophisticated. And what you do is allow consumers, retail investors, to tap into essentially quantitative hedge fund strategies and build them in like a visual way with something that almost looks like Notion, and then apply them with real money in the market. Ben, I just heard you on the Acquired podcast, which was fantastic. And something you touched on there was this idea of making a product that's both flexible and powerful. And this is something I think about a lot. I was just talking to a gaming company and a couple game developers yesterday, and we were talking about time to fun, like how quickly the user jumps in and starts using the product. And in their case with the game, it's like almost instant. How do you think about like tactically building a product that's as powerful but also flexible as something like, you know, Excel?
I mean, like really the critical trade-off here is between power and usability, right? And flexibility and usability. And I mean, unfortunately, there isn't, you know, a single silver bullet. And I think that's what makes this so hard, you know, and that's why when you have something like Excel, that's why Excel is so incredibly enduring, because it is an incredibly rare company, right? Like there are extremely few pieces of software that are both powerful and usable. Usually you have one, but not the other. And this just has to do with the fact that, life is a series of trade-offs, right? And when you think about software is all about creating abstractions, right? It's about taking a bunch of complexity and kind of hiding it. But when you create these abstraction layers and you hide some of this complexity or some of this detail, you usually give up something, right? You give up some power. And the way I'm started thinking about it a lot is like, do you have this sort of like escape hatch? So can you bring users in, give them something that's very approachable, and then as they become more sophisticated and they evolve, can they sort of like peel away the layers of the onion, or it's sort of like a Russian doll, and they can kind of like go one layer down and sort of get more into the weeds? And doing that so that you can make something approachable, but also customizable, yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And that means that we've had to really take an interdisciplinary approach. I mean, a lot of it really comes down to the team. And I think in finance applications and software, there's been a tendency to just sort of see it as like this pure math problem and not as this extraordinarily challenging usability problem. So it's a reflection of our team, right? Like it's reflected in the way we think about it, the composition of our team. Our team has these incredibly strong product people. I mean, we're still small, and people who come from more of a product background. You know, we have like our head of products background is she's a cognitive scientist by training. So it's in our DNA to have this really strong product orientation and not just say putting a layer on top of legacy financial applications, which has been the typical trajectory in fintech.
What are some of the tactical pieces, strategies that you could put in play? Do you have any favorites that people have run that you think are interesting?
You know, we have a few just different broad categories, right, that appeal to sort of like this general breakdown of systematic trading. And kind of like what Ananda was saying in the beginning, you can think of just like a 60-40 portfolio as a very, very simple systematic trading strategy, right? Like you can take 60% stocks, rebalance with 40% bonds. That's like a totally legitimate strategy. Even that, right, it sounds really simple, but even rebalancing, say, on a monthly or quarterly cadence, you know, that takes some work. Now, if we go up a level above that, automating a strategy that people have kind of done in a very ad hoc sort of seat of the pants way is something like momentum. So they might look at, as an example of a very simple momentum strategy, let's take some universe of assets, look at their trailing 90-day returns, and then take the top five. And a lot of people are doing this anyways in a manual way, but we can automate that. So we can completely automate and like literally if up to the frequency of daily, say like look every day, look at the trailing 90-day returns of all these assets and just take the ones that are the top performing and then invest in those. So that's a momentum strategy. And then we can get into things that are a little bit even more sophisticated from that. So things like risk parity. Risk parity, I mean, people have been talking about this. It's sort of even retail starting to realize that now like risk parity is a huge, huge percentage of institutional fund flows now. Like a huge portion of institutional asset managers use some form of risk parity strategy to the point that it's believed that it moves the market. Anyways, there's a reason why. It's because, frankly, those are pretty good strategies. That's not investment advice, but I will say offhand, I think they are good strategies. And until now, it's been very, very difficult and inaccessible for a retail investor to get a risk parity strategy. And a risk parity strategy just means that you look at like the volatility of a few assets and you make sure that you sort of like dynamically adjust their exposures in inverse proportion to their volatility. And the idea here, as I know that's a bit of a mouthful, is just that you have basically equal risk exposure, right? Instead of having like a fixed weight, I give 40% to this, 20% to this, 30% to that, you're saying, I want to have these assets equally rated by their risk. And we take care of that. And then lastly, another whole category that's very popular is kind of what we call like tactical asset allocation. And it's the idea of actually going in and out of different assets or portfolios based on different market conditions. So we have the ability to embed conditionals and like if-else logic so that you can go switch in and out of different assets based on, say, you know, a 200-day moving average or, you know, some sort of indicator.
And the only thing I'll add there is if all of that seemed like a mouthful and you spend a lot of time on Reddit, there's something called hedge fundies that's doing the tour of all the Reddit subreddits. So really consists of two assets, a levered S&P 500 ETF and a bond ETF. And you just rebalance that quarterly and we take care of all of that for you. And that's something that the subreddits have been talking about for months now. And it's just super easy to execute. Again, not investment advice, but
yeah, I love Ben, what you said, momentum, but doing it by the seat of your pants. That's a good way to describe, I think, the pylon in some of these growth stocks.
Absolutely.
When you talk about Reddits and things like that, this is kind of the evolution of the retail investor from, you know, there's people who are buying a lot of GameStop, but also Robinhood unlocks the ability for, I bought my first stock on Robinhood. Now it's not where I have the majority of my money anymore, but the idea that people can level up over time as they learn more about the markets and how trading works and things like that is a really interesting one. But how do you think about like that customer and finding them? And do you actually push out the product and like trading strategies through Reddits?
I mean, already organically, we're seeing a fair amount of interest in Reddit. So that's really cool. I do think the nature of having this like shareable web-based application, it is my hope, and I think already evidence that this is already happening, that, you know, it will be something that ends up being popular in Reddit. And I think, like, you can have an irreverent tone but still be smart, right? You can have fun and still be smart. And definitely, like, if you go on Wall Street Bets or whatever, yeah, there's a lot of, like, silliness. Some of it's stupid, but some of it's smart. It's just the tone is silly. And, you know, if we can make being smart fun, that's awesome. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that, like, I think there's this false dichotomy that either you're, like, this very serious, very boring, you know, mutual funder, ETF investor who dollar cost averages into ETFs in your Vanguard account, or you're YOLO trading calls on Tesla or whatever. And there's definitely a middle path in between that. And I think that's massively underserved. And I think that's what you see. There's a lot of that activity on Reddit right now. A lot of it. Of people who are like, hey, maybe there's other stuff going on here. And I think there's growing sophistication too. And I think there's been also, like, this growing awareness on a lot of these Reddits of, like, wait a minute, we've kind of been sold something that maybe isn't entirely accurate. Like, they're starting to become more and more acutely aware of, like, what hedge funds and institutions are doing. And some of that is, I think, a little irrational, or, like, sort of this, like, populist outrage, but some of it's legitimate. And I think they're saying, like, look, I don't, you know, I want to have the ability to capture this as well. And if we can facilitate that and we can give people the ability to capture some of the alpha returns that that those hedge funds have, that's awesome. I mean, that'll be pretty cool.
Candidly, when we first started the company, to your point, there was a lot of doubt. You know, you get that perpetual TAM question, and there was a lot of doubt, like, this is a market large enough. And we had so much conviction because we'd go into some of these subreddits and we saw the weekly rate of growth in just, like, subreddit channels across where people are talking about these, you know, more exciting, interesting things when it comes to their investments and really moving along from, to your point about, you know, just buying stocks to trying to do something different. And so we knew that there was something there because we just saw, you know, at the start of the pandemic, like, a lot of these subreddits were growing like crazy and people are interested in this stuff. So that's changed now 2 years later. I don't think we get that question at all anymore.
Yeah, in some ways, it feels like almost a bet that that market, that group of people, is going to continue to grow.
I think so. And I also think that sophisticated retail investors have been largely ignored. You know, again, there's this dichotomy in the way people think that, you know, I saw this thing. It's like there's the silent majority of ETF investors, and then there's this, like, very vocal minority of crazy people on Robinhood or Coinbase or whatever. And what's missing in that is that there actually already is a pretty material, like, market of people who are on tools like Interactive Brokers or Thinkorswim, and are actually pretty serious investors and traders. And for whatever reason, they're just not as vocal, I guess, and they don't make it into these sound bites as much. But those are very successful products and very successful companies. And for whatever reason, it's just not something that's attracted a lot of interest from Silicon Valley. But I mean, that created a huge opportunity for us.
Going back to the beginning a little bit, Ananda, you mentioned starting in the middle of COVID when retail investing, I think, hit the news probably in a big way. But how did you both actually get into this space of both starting this company, but even before that, you know, trading in this sophisticated way? Most people don't.
Yeah, I can start by just telling you the origin story about way back, and then I think leave the company story to Ben. But, you know, for context, Ben and I, we've known each other since university days, and we were in dorm. We were in this dorm of misfits, basically, and we were one room apart from each other in the hallway. And Ben would be that guy who, when we were 18, was kind of walking up and down the hallway, talking about how stochastic calculus could be used to, like, predict asset prices. And I'm still friends with him, but my eyes did glaze over at the time. But long story short, I kind of ended up in tech through, like, a roundabout way in finance, whereas Ben kind of went right into tech. And I think this is a problem that's been kind of top of mind for him for a long time. So when he brought it up to me, it was just like, oh, wow, okay. We see, like, there's so much potential for this. And probably kick it over to him to explain that.
The origins of Composer really started when I had left my last real job, I guess. So I left Breather. I was an executive there. I had left there and I had this like downtime where I had some money and I wanted to invest it. And I was like super disappointed with what I was finding. I was like shocked. I figured that I'd find like some good retail options. So as like a fun side project, just to distract myself, I started to like code up white papers of some very basic strategies, like risk parity type strategies, things like that, trying to implement these strategies with my own money. And again, like at this time, it was like just for fun more than anything. And like Composer grew into a company very serendipitously. You know, it grew from playing around and experimenting and then sharing what I was working on just because I was excited about it and having friends and family say, you know what, like this is really interesting. Like I want access to this too. And that's when the light bulb went off that like, wait a minute, there's like a really underserved market opportunity here. Like this is not just something that I'm interested in. This is something where I realized that there was a hugely larger, disproportionate number of people who could actually understand these strategies and want to benefit from them relative to the number of people who could actually implement and execute them. And that's because, you know, a lot of these strategies, again, they're not that complicated to understand, but there's so much incidental complexity in the way. There's so much crap you have to deal with to actually like set up a, you know, how many people want to like set up a trading server, buy institutional grade data, right? Like that's really expensive too. Like the initial setup costs are so high in both like money and time. That even if you knew how to code, it's like a huge pain in the ass, right? Like, so that means that like, you know, that's a huge opportunity for software. This is a huge opportunity for technology. Because if you can abstract away a lot of that complexity and close that gap, that implementation gap, you now have this huge opportunity of this market that would love to take advantage of these things if you can just make it a little bit easier to execute. And then essentially COVID hit and we actually all had the opportunity. Ronnie and Ananda, Ronnie's not on this call, but he's our CTO. And the three of us have all known each other for a while. And we said like, yeah, let's just do this. So like when we started, we were just working, we were all in different places. I was actually living in Nicaragua at the time. And like, I was like financing the company. We were financing the company through like, the Canadian government gives like checks for surviving during COVID. We were like using those checks to like, make e-transfers to like pay for stuff. Like it was like that scrappy, right? Like no salary, nothing, no real connections to raising money or anything like that. Just trying to grind it out. And I mean, the rest is history.
As you may have heard, I'm a big fan of what Marketer Hire is doing to make it easy for startups to find marketing talent. Getting the right marketing professionals takes way too long for ambitious businesses. But using advanced AI and in-house vetting, Marketer Hire makes finding your perfect match so much faster. You'll have access to elite freelance marketing professionals ready to work as little or as much as you need. Sign up today or get matched with a no-risk trial at marketerhire.com. It's an amazing start. And one of the obvious questions there is you turn all of that difficult backend stuff into just a really simple, powerful, usable web tool where I can now invest my money and run these strategies. And it's also very social. But the obvious question is like, how do you solve some of those hard problems? And like, what are some of the hardest problems you'd had to solve on the backend to make this seamless for users to now be able to run strategies at scale?
Very fair question. It's something we deal with, you know, it's ongoing. Which is why I'm like, okay, if you want to try this at home, like good luck, you know, like there are big DIY communities, but like, my God, I don't even know. And I have to say, I think some of them are not aware of like some of the issues that they're probably affecting their trading. So, I mean, I think the most obvious one is just data. Like everything in finance depends on data and the quality of your data. And even today, it is non-trivial to get clean data, to get good data for both backtesting, but also for trade execution. You know, there are not really that many good out of the box data platforms for that. I mean, just and so like just something as simple as backtesting, you know, that is unbelievably laborious and arduous just to get a good backtest of a strategy that actually simulates conditions correctly. I was listening to like Jim Simmons at like Rentec speaking, he's saying like they've spent like years building accurate backtesting. That's a huge part of their moat, and I think that giving people that is an example of something that takes a lot of work. It's not something that just like works out of the box. So that's one thing. I mean, I think Ananda can speak about some of the like the legal challenges and things like that. I mean, there's a lot operational and there's a lot.
Yeah, I just have this vivid image in my mind of when we were going out to raise our seed round. We had this slide in our deck that basically walked through the very steps someone would have to go through to do this on their own. It was like 30 little boxes, each of, you know, which took like hours of time connected together. And basically our investors looked in this like, this is incredibly confusing and please take it out of the deck. But point being that, you know, there's so much work that an individual have to go through. And yeah. Also, when we were first building the product, we'd get some of our early beta testers send us like spreadsheets and various things that they were using right now to hack this stuff together. And I remember this one early user who was like a senior machine learning engineer. So obviously, you know, very capable person, and was using the spreadsheet to execute trades and had all sorts of like complex standard deviation calculations and stuff in it. And then when we dug into the calculations, like they were wrong. So for years, this person had just been trading off a spreadsheet that was providing them the wrong output in terms of what needed to be traded. And then to add on to all of that, there's the legal complexity and these other things that come into play, and not being flagged as a pattern day trader and so on and so forth. So it's a wicked problem and a lot of entropy that needs to be wrangled.
Billions and billions of dollars have been lost because of Excel copy paste errors. Like there was the London Whale, right? Who like there was some copy paste errors in an Excel workbook that this trader who was like trading like credit default swaps or whatever lost. He used to make such big trades that they called him the London Whale because he like moved the market, and he lost billions of dollars. And it turned out like that it was actually largely a result of like some basic copy paste errors. I mean, like that's just insane. Like the whole financial system still largely runs on Excel. So yeah, like looking at like what people were using, like a lot of times is like they were just using Excel workbooks, but like these Excel workbooks like made my eyes bleed, and like almost all of them like had obvious errors in them. And it's like, you know, it's just not the right medium to manage these sorts of complex projects in, because like these errors just propagate and they're very hard to spot.
It's pretty wild because this is complex math. You know, it's not rocket science, but it's not that far off when you're looking at some of the math that's going into some of these strategies. And if you had do-it-yourself rocket communities, a lot of them would explode, which I guess in this case is like losing billions of dollars.
I mean, I was even talking about that today. I think there's just like a real case for a certain degree of consolidation and centralization, where like there are just certain fixed costs and things that like upfront sort of R&D that's just better left to like an entity that handles this, right? Than having all these people reinventing the wheel each time, and in the process of reinventing the wheel, introducing all kinds of errors. It just doesn't make sense. Like even for me selfishly, like I am a user of Composer for this reason. I don't want to do this myself. Like I just don't. It's like, and I'm the founder. I don't feel confident in by myself. I like having a team where we actually have like a central code base where people can actually like review each other's work, and we have all these people and all these customers reviewing this, and we keep iterating it and making it better so that every time there is any sort of mistake, we can correct it. Without that kind of process, man, I'm just like, I wouldn't be confident.
I mean, it feels like the perfect example of a startup coming into a really fragmented market and building just like a vertical player that does something really well and just iterates on that single product. Except in this case, there aren't really even other players. The other players are do-it-yourself Excel workbooks, mostly.
Mostly, yeah. I mean, I think there's some stuff happening. Anything that's a good idea, eventually you get competitors. I do think at least within equities, yeah, we're pretty unique. We're still very unique.
It feels like part of the why now is that you've had this in part boom in retail trading that's been driven by all of these exchanges coming online and driving costs to zero. But then on top of that, you have this market of investors growing and becoming more sophisticated. So you have more users every day in theory. And then the question there is then, where do you generate revenue from? Do you generate revenue from every transaction? How does that work?
The nice thing about money is there's a lot of money in money. So right now, Composer is actually completely free to use. So anybody can sign up and they don't pay any upfront costs or fees. And obviously all of this is subject to change in the future. But as of now, yeah, it's totally free. You can sign up on composer.trade today and start playing around. The interesting thing about trading apps is that they have the ability to make money in a number of indirect ways that really either don't affect the consumer or even beneficial to them. So one of those ways, for example, is like net interest margin, right? Like you can lend the cash balances out that people have dormant in their accounts. You know, another way is through margin or securities lending. So that makes up a lot. A way that a lot of apps make money right now is through payment for order flow, right? That's what's made trading free. And obviously that has, it's a bit controversial and a bit taboo. But in general, it's actually, and I talked about this on the Acquired podcast, but the PFOF or payment for order flow has net on net, in my opinion, actually reduced costs and transaction costs and spreads for consumers. So there's a bunch of ways that you can make money that are actually sort of symbiotic and mutually beneficial with the customer. And then obviously there's some things we have in the roadmap for future revenue expansion that are that we have coming up on the horizon that are secret, but that are really exciting and novel.
Beyond Composer, in this space of fintech, the area where you're working in, are there other companies that you, or trends that you think are really exciting right now?
It's a really good question. We're so hyper-focused on what we're building, but yeah, I mean, I do generally, like we've had a lot of debates about this internally. Obviously, like a lot of the Web3 stuff is super interesting. I think that there will be, I think it's a bit like the late 90s tech bubble in the sense that, and I mean this in more positive terms than it might seem, which is to say like, yes, like 98 to 99% of stuff ended up being bullshit and just washing out. But that the 1% that remained, it ended up being completely transformative. And that's, if I had to like make an armchair prediction about like Web3, for example, I do think it's one of these spaces that most of the stuff will like fail, but then there will be things that emerge from this that are pretty fascinating. One of the reasons I find it interesting is this concept of like data interoperability. It is incredibly hard, for example, to say, like, let's say you have a bank account or a brokerage, to have that interoperate with other applications. Like, even if it has an API, like, it just, like, the protocols don't work well. It just, like, doesn't work well. Whereas, like, if you have a MetaMask wallet, I was talking about this with my designer the other day, like, it's so cool that you can, like, literally just log in with your MetaMask wallet. And it's like one of these things that I don't even think was, like, one of the intentional original use cases, but I was saying, like, if nothing else, maybe Web3 doesn't achieve all the things it wants right out the gate, but if nothing else, just, like, the fact that it's like a universal like password manager even is just like that alone is impressive. Like just the fact that it like allows you to self-custody certain types of data. You have like finally you actually have proper single sign-on. Just that alone is actually a pretty impressive invention. So I've been really impressed. With that stuff. I feel a little dated sometimes looking at it, but I think it's like one of those things where they shot for the moon and the land on the stars, and I think there's going to be some really interesting,
or vice versa.
yeah, exactly, exactly right. Seriously, yeah. And then the last thing that I'm excited about is, I guess now I'm going to sound a bit like a armchair economist or something or political scientist, but I do think that a lot of what's happening right now, we're going to start actually investing back into Adam's businesses. Like there's just been so much more return on software. One of the things that I'm excited about just as a human being is to actually see evolution and advances in energy, in supply chains, in logistics, all those things, and moving around atoms. People tend to ignore that. Like that's my old world is like atoms. And like, yeah, it's so frustrating. It's so much, let's be honest, it's so much easier to make money in software. but now finally, there's going to be this huge impetus where it's like, okay, now there's actually enough collective willpower, enough incentive that people are going to say, okay, like we actually have to figure this stuff out. The real world still really matters. And I think coming out of COVID, that's the other big realization. Like, frankly, I'm more interested in that stuff than like the metaverse. Like I'm more interested in like making the real world function well again, you know, and moving goods around effectively, doing things with in energy efficient ways. Like those things are going to be more critical than ever, in part for just, for geopolitical reasons, for reasons of national security, that sort of stuff, I think we're going to see a resurgence there. And that I'm super excited about because the reality is, you know, total factor productivity and all of that. Like, we've had a lot, you know, we talk all about tech and it's so amazing, but like, we haven't actually seen like a huge boom in productivity. So again, I think that like, you know, I'm an eternal optimist long-term, and I think we're finally going to see that productivity breakthrough that everybody's been kind of like missing in the secular stagnation of the last 20 years. We're going to finally see huge increases in real world productivity. I don't want to be too sort of minimizing fintech and innovation there. I do think that if you look throughout history, financial innovation really has been contemporaneous with a lot of other more fundamental innovation in the sciences and in technology. So coming up with new models for financing and capitalizing businesses is going to be more important than ever. Like, that is also another thing I should say is like, I do think that there's a lot to be said that like a lot of the world still does not have access to capital. Right, there's a lot of really talented people all over the world. That's a space I'm also really interested in, and just like mobilizing capital so that like someone who's really smart, who can be really productive, can actually get access to capital. Because the reality is, it's still like, yeah, like doing deals over Zoom, yada yada. But it's still very hard for most people on Earth. Like, your average person on Earth cannot start a venture backed company easily. And lowering barriers to creating venture backed companies, like that is a massive catalyst. Like it does really matter. It's not just like, I think there's sometimes the perception that like, you know, yes, there is such things like over financialization where it's like there's not actual real gains to society from it. That's cool. That stuff's really cool.
Coming back to Composer, talking about the kind of social movement of money, this actually feels like a very social product, like more social than almost any other finance product I can think of, in that you're building these strategies and then you share them. And these strategies and the way people learn about these things is not in a vacuum, largely. And it often is done within these internet communities. And you made it shareable on purpose. So how are you leveraging that social piece?
Yeah, so obviously we have a lot in the pipeline there. Some of it is top secret, but some of it I can share. So definitely one thing we want to do is in the future, we want to unleash the creativity of our community and actually allow people to not just share, so they can already do that. I want them to actually be able to monetize their creations and their ideas. So sort of like creating a two-sided marketplace. I think that that's the future. So we could literally like turn the way that asset management even works, like the way that distribution even works, so that like you can actually have like these citizen creators, fund managers, in essence, on our platform. So I think that's going to be huge. So if you can actually make a living on Composer, like that would be so cool. That's definitely a huge piece that's going to be coming in the pipeline.
Oh, so like I design a strategy and then other people can use it, and then people are always coming on to use my new strategies, and also because it's my IP, I get paid a dollar every time they use it, or I get paid one.
Hopefully more than a dollar, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, there are models here that I really hope that in the future someone can make like a very, very lucrative living doing that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's wild. Super interesting. I mean, in tech, people hate the word democratization because it's overused, yeah. But really that's what powerful tools do, is they allow people to do things that could have only been done in the past by these giant organizations with huge amounts of capital, like hedge funds and like compliance teams. And you make one really powerful tool, whether it's like AI that does CGI for you. So what might have taken a team a week now takes one person 10 minutes. You're doing the same thing, but for financialization or for finance.
Yeah. And there's something interesting here, which is that, you know, throughout history, anything that started off as institutional has eventually trickled down to retail. So even like robo-advisors, they basically, you know, replaced your a mutual fund manager or wealth manager that was just picking assets for you. And, you know, they gave that power to the hands of retail investors. Same with, you know, no commission trading. Like, institutions always got better rates, and then that's trickled down. So we just see what we're doing as like a continuation along the evolution of that path. And giving more power into the hands of retail.
Well, my last question for everybody on the show is about vision. Where would you like to see Composer in 10 or even 15 years?
I mean, that's a long time. But yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, like, I want to take over this industry. I want to be bigger than Interactive Brokers, right? Like, I want to be bigger than the biggest brokers. You know, right now what we have, this is just our initial wedge. This is our foothold. But we think that we can take this over and give people a fun, smart way to invest, and then ultimately in the future actually create a livelihood through this. So we really are, in 10 to 15 years, wanting to completely reinvent asset management from first principles. Just like literally look at the entire value chain of this industry and say, hey, we're going to rewrite this with software. Nothing short of that.
Yeah, I think Ben's hit the nail on the head. It's really about changing the game.
Yeah, it's an amazing vision, and it's a testament to, in some ways, I guess, community. Like these do-it-yourself communities, I'm going to have to start looking for some very dedicated communities online and subreddits and think about building products. And also, you know, like the next stage in the evolution of finance. So yeah, it's fascinating. And thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Joe. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was fun.